Imagine, if you will, a Broadway musical with absolutely no plot.
Right.
There is no, grand hero's journey for you to follow, no chronological story mapping out a protagonist's dramatic rise and fall. Instead, you are just watching a single guy turning 35, blowing out his birthday candles, and spending the next 2 hours deeply analyzing the messy, chaotic, and sometimes downright terrifying marriages of his best friends.
It's quite a concept.
It really is. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are thrilled to have you with us as we explore the source material surrounding Company, the groundbreaking 1970 musical with music and lyrics by the legendary Stephen Sondheim, and a book which, in theater terms, simply means the spoken dialogue and script by George Firth.
It is so wonderful to dive into this with you. And we aren't just going to be looking at the what of this musical's plot, because like you noted, the plot is essentially just a series of intimate character studies.
Yeah, exactly.
We are really going to dig into the why. Why did an episodic, nonlinear story about upper middle class New Yorkers complaining about their spouses manage to strike such a profound universal chord? I mean, it's still being fiercely celebrated half a century later.
It's wild.
Yeah.
Our mission for this deep dive is to figure out how this so-called concept musical completely revolutionized modern theater. We are going to examine its incredibly timeless and honestly pretty cynical themes of commitment.
Very cynical at times.
Oh, absolutely. And we are going to uncover how the show itself has constantly shape-shifted over 50 years to stay entirely relevant to whatever generation happens to be watching it.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the origin story of Company is bizarre. Going through these sources, it is clear this didn't even start out as a musical.
Not at all. The DNA of this show actually began as the series of 11 one-act plays written by George Firth, and they were specifically planned for the actress Kim Stanley to star in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they were just bite-sized, completely disconnected domestic dramas. So the material somehow gets into the hands of Anthony Perkins, who wants to direct it.
Right.
Perkins then passes it along to Stephen Sondheim. Sondheim reads these short plays and decides to ask the legendary director and producer, Harold Prince, for his opinion.
The great Hal Prince.
One and only. And Harold Prince looks at these separate plays and tells Sondheim that this could actually be a really good basis for a musical about New York marriages. But Prince had a brilliant caveat. He told them they needed a central character to observe all these marriages.
What's fascinating here is how that single piece of advice birthed the entire concept musical structure that Company is famous for today.
Yeah.
By adding that central character Robert, or Bobby, as his married friends call him, the creators were freed from the constraints of a traditional narrative. They completely abandoned the rules of a linear plot.
They just threw them out.
Exactly. Instead, they built the show around disconnected vignettes. The entire musical essentially takes place inside Bobby's mind, or at least around the loose, surreal framework of his 35th birthday party.
And the vignettes themselves are incredible. They are hyper-specific, hilarious, and sometimes incredibly dark.
Oh, very dark.
In Act One, we follow Bobby as he visits his married friends, and every single couple is a completely different flavor of dysfunction. First, you have Sarah and Harry. Sarah is a foodie who is obsessively dieting, and Harry is a recovering alcoholic.
A great pairing.
Right. They start taunting each other about their respective vices, and the tension escalates until they are literally having a full-blown karate match in their living room.
It's so jarring, but Sondheim uses this physical, borderline aggressive karate match to show you a profound insight into relationships. Sometimes the very things that make a couple look completely dysfunctional to the outside world are the exact glue holding their marriage together.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And that physical thrashing prompts another character, Joanne, who is the oldest, most cynical, and most frequently divorced of the friends, to comment that it's the little things that make a marriage work. It immediately establishes a tone that marriage changes everything and nothing at all.
I want to look at the scene with Peter and Susan next, because it's a massive shift in tone. Bobby visits them out on their apartment terrace. Peter is an Ivy League guy. Susan is a Southern belle. They seem like the picture-perfect couple.
They really do.
And then, right to Bobby's face, they cheerfully announce they're getting a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
How did a 1970s theater audience process a happily divorced couple?
I mean, it completely subverts the audience's expectation of what a failed marriage looks like. It forces you to question the rigid definitions of success in a relationship.
Which gets even weirder later in the show when Bobby finds out they are still living together despite the divorce. They actually claim their relationship is much stronger now that they aren't legally bound.
It's brilliant.
Then there's the scene with David and Jenny. They are a chic, uptight couple, and they decide to smoke marijuana with Bobby. They start grilling Bobby about why he isn't married. But the psychological twist here is that David privately reveals to Bobby that Jenny doesn't even like marijuana.
Right.
She only smokes it as a performance, a show of her love for David.
And while Bobby is observing all these terrifying compromises, he is simultaneously juggling three different girlfriends.
Oh, the girlfriends.
You have April, who is a rather slow-witted flight attendant. Kathy, an old flame who reveals she is actually leaving for Cape Cod with a new fiancé. And Marta, who is obsessed with the dirty, crowded, uncaring magic of New York City.
Such a great contrast.
The contrast between Bobby's life and his friends' lives is brilliant. All of Bobby's married male friends are deeply envious of his commitment-free status. But Bobby himself is waiting for some impossible hybrid woman who merges the best features of all his married friends.
Which brings us to the absolute chaotic masterpiece of Act One, the wedding scene. Have you ever looked at a friend's relationship and thought they were making a massive mistake?
We've all been there.
Amy and Paul have been living together for years, and they are finally tying the knot. But on the morning of the wedding, Amy gets a massive case of cold feet. She literally breaks the fourth wall, meaning she looks right past the other actors and sings directly to you, the audience.
It's a frantic moment.
She pours out her panic in this incredibly fast song called Getting Married Today. She self-destructs over every petty thing she can think of and actually calls off the wedding, sending Paul storming out into the rain.
In that moment, intense vulnerability, Bobby steps in to comfort her. But he emotionally miscalculates the situation entirely. He impulsively offers an impromptu proposal, suggesting that he and Amy should just get married instead.
Out of nowhere.
Exactly.
And that sheer absurdity is exactly what jolts Amy back to reality. The idea of marrying Bobby is so crazy to her that it instantly cures her panic attack. She runs right out after Paul, finally ready to commit.
It's a great turning point.
Act One ends with Bobby back at his birthday party, finally making a wish. But Act Two is where the emotional climax really hits us.
Act Two pushes Bobby completely out of his safe, passive observer role. The pivotal moment happens in a nightclub with Joanne and her husband, Larry. Joanne gets thoroughly drunk and delivers one of the most famous numbers in musical theater, The Ladies Who Lunch.
Bye.
She passes harsh, biting judgment on rich, middle-aged women who waste their lives away with meaningless activities. But her harshest criticism is reserved for people exactly like herself who just watch life happen. She reveals that all these ladies are bound together by a profound existential terror that comes with the knowledge that everybody dies.
If you have ever felt that late night existential dread, you will immediately relate to Joanne's breakdown. It is bleak, but incredibly powerful. And Larry just takes her drunken rant without a single complaint, quietly explaining to Bobby that he still loves her dearly.
He's so patient.
When Larry steps away to pay the check, Joanne bluntly propositions Bobby. She invites him to begin an affair, assuring him she will take care of him. And Bobby responds, almost surprising himself, "But who will I take care of?" He gets angry and demands, "Joanne, what do you get out of marriage?"
That confrontation is the breakthrough. It forces Bobby to stop hiding behind his friends' messy lives, which prompts the final soaring number of the show, Being Alive.
Such a powerful song.
Bobby starts the song, still enumerating all the traps and dangers he perceives in marriage, the smothering, the compromising. But as his friends counter his fears in his mind, his lyrics change. He expresses a desperate, urgent desire for loving intimacy. He finally decides he wants someone to face the challenge of living with, even with all the problems that commitment brings.
It is a staggering emotional journey to watch. But the drama on stage in 1970 was nothing compared to the real-life drama happening behind the scenes.
Oh, the behind-the-scenes stuff is fascinating.
Let's talk about the original Broadway run, because the psychological weight of this material was heavy. The actor Dean Jones originally played Robert, but the show's cynical, unvarnished take on marriage hit way too close to home for him.
In his autobiography, Jones wrote that while Company was a clever, bright show on the surface, its underlying message declared that marriage was, at best, a vapid compromise. He called the show insoluble and finally destructive.
Do you think he had a point, though? Is the show actually overly cynical, or was he just projecting his own marital trauma onto the script?
That's a great question.
Because he actually cited stress and depression over the collapse of his own marriage as the reason he couldn't continue, and he quit the production shortly after it opened.
It is a valid critique, depending on your perspective.
No.
If you view marriage as a flawless fairy tale, Company absolutely feels like a horror story. Jones was living through a painful divorce, so the mirror the show held up was simply too painful for him to look into every night.
His departure led to a very rare move by the Tony Awards Committee. Jones's understudy, Larry Kurt, took over the role of Bobby. Kurt was a seasoned performer. He had created the role of Tony in West Side Story, and his performance in Company earned rave reviews.
He was incredible in it.
He was so good that the committee made a rare exception, allowing Kurt to be nominated for Best Actor in a Musical as a replacement. That is an honor almost universally reserved for the actor who originates a role.
It highlights just how demanding the role of Bobby is. And if you want to understand the grueling nature of this show, you have to look at the cult classic documentary by D.A. Pennebaker called Original Cast Album,
yes.
Company. It captured the unvarnished reality of the original cast recording session.
It is a legendary piece of theater history.
Yeah.
Imagine being in a recording studio for 14 hours straight. You see Sondheim and the cast just exhausted, their voices shot, pushing themselves to the absolute physical and emotional limit to capture the complex score.
It's exhausting just to watch.
It strips away all the Broadway glamour and leaves you with the raw sweat and tears of making art. But speaking of behind-the-scenes chaos, here's where it gets really interesting. I was looking through the sources, and there's a wild anecdote about a 2007 production by the Kookaburra Musical Theatre in Sydney, Australia. What exactly happened there?
Oh, it is a cardinal sin in professional theater. The show was running, it was well received. Sondheim himself even traveled to Australia for the first time in 30 years to attend the opening night.
Wow, so a big deal.
Huge deal. But during the run, the actress playing April fell ill. Now, normally an understudy simply steps in, but the production had failed to hire an understudy for the role.
Oh no, so what do? Cancel the performance?
The chief executive, Peter Cousins, insisted the show had to go on anyway. But without the character of April entirely.
Wait, what?
They completely cut her character. They dropped several musical numbers and scenes without giving any explanation to the audience. And the performance just ended 20 minutes early.
Picture yourself sitting in that audience in Sydney. You've paid for a ticket to a Sondheim masterpiece, and they just chop a third of the show out and send you home early.
The audience backlash was massive. There was considerable negative press attention. Sondheim was so enraged by this artistic butchery that he threatened to completely revoke the production rights for the show.
I don't blame him.
It goes to show how delicate the balance of this concept musical really is. You cannot simply hack a piece of the puzzle out without the entire psychological framework collapsing.
But while you can't just haphazardly chop pieces out of it, Company is actually uniquely adaptable when it is reimagined intentionally.
Yeah.
In fact, over the last 50 years, it has constantly evolved to reflect new generations.
It really has.
Let's look at the 2006 Broadway revival directed by John Doyle. He completely reimagined the staging by using an actor-musician concept. The actors themselves were the orchestra.
It was a brilliant way to visually represent the interconnectedness and the chaotic noise of Bobby's life. Instead of an orchestra in a pit, the cast playing instruments on stage represented the constant soundtrack of Bobby's anxieties.
The visual imagery was striking. You had Raul Esparza playing Bobby, providing his own percussion, and Heather Laws playing the frantic bride Amy somehow managed to play the French horn, the trumpet, and the flute.
Amazing.
I cannot even fathom the lung capacity required to sing the rapid-fire lyrics of Getting Married Today and then immediately pick up a French horn. It is mind-blowing. But as impressive as that 2006 staging was, the most massive evolution of the show came with the 2018 West End and 2021 Broadway revivals directed by Marianne Elliott.
The gender-bent production.
Exactly. They completely gender-bent the production. Bobby became Bobby, a female role played first by Rosalie Craig in London and then Katrina Lenk on Broadway.
And that wasn't the only fundamental shift. Amy, the panicked bride, became Jamie, a panicked groom. He was played by Jonathan Bailey and later Matt Doyle.
Which is such a big change.
It transformed the wedding scene entirely and introduced the show's first same-sex couple as Jamie was panicking about marrying his devoted fiancé, Paul.
It is such a brilliant modern flip. But you have to wonder how Stephen Sondheim, the original creator who meticulously crafted these characters in 1970, felt about someone coming in and completely rewriting the genders of his iconic roles.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, Sondheim's reaction tells you everything you need to know about his genius. Marianne Elliott sent him an email to pitch the idea of changing Amy into a man.
Okay.
She wrote, "Steve, you have to be sitting down, you have to be having a glass of wine in your hand, and take a deep breath, but I'm going to say something to you. I think possibly we should change Amy into a man."
I would be terrified to send that email. What did he say?
Sondheim replied, Marianne, you need to be sitting down. You need to have a glass of wine in your hand. You need to take a deep breath. I think it's a great idea.
That is so cool.
He immediately and enthusiastically embraced it. He believes strongly that theater is distinguished from film specifically because it can be done differently from generation to generation. He stated, what keeps theater alive is the chance always to do it differently, with not only fresh casts, but fresh viewpoints. It's not just a matter of changing pronouns, but attitudes.
That gives me chills. And that 2021 Broadway revival carries such a poignant emotional weight when you look at the timeline. It began previews in March 2020 and was originally slated to open on Sondheim's 90th birthday.
Right, but then the pandemic hit.
Exactly. After only 9 previews, the coronavirus pandemic shut everything down. Broadway went entirely dark.
It was an incredibly uncertain time for the theater community, but the production held on. They finally resumed previews in November 2021, and Sondheim was there. He attended the show shortly before his death at age 91 on November 26, 2021.
5 days before he died, he was giving interviews talking about how thrilled he was with the gender-swapped Bobby. Following his passing, the cast, the musicians, and the crew dedicated their entire run to him.
It was a beautiful tribute.
It transformed the revival from just a modern update into this powerful, living tribute to the late composer. It's incredibly moving to think about that cast performing Being Alive just days after losing the man who wrote it.
And his work continues to morph globally, proving the material has this endless flexibility. For instance, in 2021, Antonio Banderas directed and starred in a Spanish production of Company in Malaga.
Oh, right.
And Sondheim actually approved changing Bobby's age from 35 to 50 for that specific production.
Which totally shifts the cultural context.
Mm-hmm.
A 35-year-old bachelor in 1970 has a very different cultural weight than a 50-year-old bachelor today, or a 35-year-old single woman today, navigating biological clocks and modern dating expectations.
Absolutely.
So what does this all mean? When we look at all these sources, all these iterations, Company is clearly far more than just a time capsule of 1970s dating culture. It is a mirror.
A very clear mirror.
Whether Bobby is a 35-year-old guy in New York, a 50-year-old man in Spain, or a modern woman in a gender-swapped reality, the core emotions remain untouched. That deep-seated terror of being alone, the hilarious and messy compromises of long-term relationships, the fear that everybody dies, so we better find someone to sit next to on the couch. Those are entirely universal human experiences.
This raises an important question, though, a thought for you to carry with you after we wrap up today. If Company was originally built to reflect the contemporary realities of dating and marriage in 1970, what happens to this musical as the very institution of marriage fundamentally changes?
That's a deep question.
Think about it. If someone revives Company 50 years from now in a society where traditional milestones like a 35th birthday or a formal legal wedding might be completely obsolete, how will the musical look? Will Joanne's terror that everybody dies still drive humans to seek out lifelong commitment? Or will the concept of being alive require a brand new definition altogether?
That is a fascinating thought to leave on, and something for you to ponder the next time you look at the relationships in your own life. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the source material behind Company. We invite you to keep questioning, keep listening, and keep exploring the fascinating, ever-changing world around you. Until next time.